You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition. Table Talk is the podcast that showcases the visionaries of the food industry. It digs deep into the latest innovations and questions everything we think we know about food. Today's episode is all about challenging obesity, and we're going to find out why fat shaming is counterproductive and why cake sales are the bane of health professionals' lives. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Now, the government published its obesity strategy last summer, but for many critics, it didn't go far enough. Turning the Tide is a new approach backed by 40 different organisations, and they believe this strategy could change the course of the UK's obesity epidemic. Now, it's difficult to find projects that show genuine, quantifiable success in this area. So why is this initiative going to be different? Well, to guide me through it, I'm joined by Caroline Cherney, who is Alliance Lead at the Obesity Health Alliance. Hello there, Caroline. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
So lots of exciting stuff to talk about here, but before we get onto the obesity strategy, just tell me this. Why are you driven to tackle such an immensely difficult task? I mean, nobody's managed this before, really. It's a mountain to climb. Are you a glutton for punishment?
Well, I think it's fair to say no country in the world has managed to reduce obesity, across their population. We do think that the UK could be the first. We've seen some very encouraging signs. We've got a government that is absolutely committed to improving the health of its population. You know, we're all now very aware of the impact that excess weight has on our health at a population level. The reason why the Obesity Health Alliance exists is because we're a coalition of health charities. So my background is I was at Cancer Research UK, and now we work with other health charities such as the British Heart Foundation, Diabetes UK, with medical royal colleges, and also with campaign groups. And all of us, you know, working in health charities or, you know, working in medical organisations, over the last few years have become increasingly concerned about the impact that excess weight is having on disease risk. So we're seeing much higher prevalence of things like type 2 diabetes. We're seeing more and more cancers that we think are linked to excess weight. We think in the next few years or so, particularly in women, that excess weight will overtake tobacco as a preventable cause of cancer. And obesity is, you know, as you said, it's a really, really complex area. But there are some aspects of it that are modifiable. And so we do think that with the right policies in place and a shift in how we view obesity and how we view excess weight, you know, the really key thing is that we stop seeing it as a, you know, a failing, an individual failing, and we take much more action on the environmental factors that influence our weight. You know, we do think we can turn the tide, yeah.
Okay, so tell me just in broad terms what Turning the Tide is about and who's behind it.
The Obesity Health Alliance is made up of 45 health organisations, charities, medical royal colleges, and campaign groups. And we exist to, I suppose, speak with one voice when it comes to government policy on healthy weight, to agree on a kind of a set of priorities and, you know, then advocate government action on policies that will improve healthy weight. And the policy environment has changed quite significantly in the last 5 years. You know, when I started doing this job 6 years ago, there were certain things that we couldn't really talk about. They seemed to be, you know, too kind of politically tricky. Things like food taxes, for example, was just a, you know, an area that no one was really very comfortable talking about. But since then, we've had the soft drinks industry levy, you know, the sugar tax, as most people know it, and, you know, much more political interest in the role of the environment and the role of the food system, particularly. So what we wanted to do with Turning the Tide was to really set out a long-term agenda to get the NGO community, to get the research community together and say, okay, what does the evidence tell us about what are the factors that are really driving obesity in the UK at the moment? And what are the interventions that we think have the most promising evidence? And where do we think the government needs to go in the next 10 years? You know, can we all agree this kind of, you know, this long-term plan? Mm-hmm. And then that allows us as a community to then start to advocate for these actions over the next few years.
Okay, so before we get into the detail of what's in it, let's look at what you're tackling in the first place. So, you know, there have been two tumultuous years. We've had lockdown, and then we had the government's proposed strategy to deal with that. Tell us about what your view of the government's strategy, the obesity strategy.
So it's very much a step in the right direction. I think the most compelling thing about it wasn't just about children. In previous years, government strategies about obesity have been very much focused on children. And there's a very powerful argument for that because, you know, we do have high rates of childhood obesity in the UK, and children with obesity are much more likely to become adults with obesity. So there's a very, very compelling argument for, you know, getting in there and trying to, you know, prevent it early. But that ignores the hundreds of thousands of adults who are living with obesity and, you know, also deserve the policies that can improve their health. So we were very pleased to see that, you know, the Tackling Obesity strategy of last year actually focused on improving adults' health as well. Very positively, it also picked up a number of policy commitments that had been made by previous governments, but then left to languish, things like restricting advertising of unhealthy food and drinks on TV and online, and restricting promotions. So, you know, quite a lot of it wasn't new, but it moved things along.
So just to fill in the information there, there's plans to ban advertising after 9 p.m. for unhealthy food aimed at kids, and to encourage calorie labelling on meals and takeaways. Any other sort of parts of those that you would see as the building blocks of the obesity strategy, so our listeners understand what was on the table?
Yeah, so there were the restrictions around marketing and promotions, calorie labelling, as you said. And the other key part of it as well was an expansion of weight management services. It really made a commitment to try and, you know, address the postcode issue that we see at the moment, where people, you know, maybe end up on long waiting lists if they're trying to get help with weight management or don't have services available to them in their area. So it committed, you know, funding to try and make services more accessible to more people.
And that's interesting, because suddenly that's where they actually have to do something that costs money, whereas plans to ban things and to encourage calorie, that's all about regulation and legislation. But actually putting money into something is a shift. So what do you think that is missed in the obesity strategy?
Oh, well, quite a lot. I mean, no one strategy is going to do everything. And I think that, you know, that's the really key point about everything in this area. And, you know, most of public health, in fact, there aren't these big, you know, silver bullet game-changing policies that are just going to solve the problem. It's about lots and lots and lots of small incremental measures that all work together and all build up over time. So I think we think of the Tackling Obesity strategy as the first layer of those measures. So it's picking out some of the most pernicious examples of marketing, but there's still a whole raft of other marketing ways of reaching us all that will need to be addressed in the future. It doesn't really look at food formulation. We've got an existing reformulation program in the UK designed to reduce sugar. It hasn't been ever so successful across some of the most sugary products. So we'd definitely like to see more to disincentive food industry from, you know, producing very sugary, very calorific foods. We need more in the early years, for example. So this is an area that is, you know, it's so important because, you know, the children's health in the first few years of their life really sets out their trajectory, their health in the future. And previous government strategies just haven't really focused on early years at all.
And would you say that what you're proposing is more about the legislative side of things or the regulatory side of things, or is it about the government having to stump up some cash and actually do something proactive?
It's both. I mean, I think, you know, you said before that you know, regulation is a really powerful tool that we have. And when it comes to the food system, you know, it's not a case of we don't need to put more money into the food system, but we need to regulate to kind of correct some of the market failures that have led to a food system that is profitable on the basis of unhealthy food, and try and shift it towards a model that becomes profitable on the basis of food that improves our health, you know, which we think can be done, but it needs regulation. And, you know, where we need to invest money is in services, in things like early years and support services.
Now, you've very successfully managed to get a whole group of diverse organisations to back this idea. How do you work together to maximise the impact that you can have? And has it been easy to come up with a cohesive message? Because a lot of stakeholders, all with different, you know, reasons for being part of it, must be quite difficult juggling that group.
it's a bit of a cat herding process sometimes. I mean, when the OHA was first set up, you know, we really learned from other similar coalitions in other areas of public health, like the Smoke Free Action Coalition, who had very successfully brought everyone together. And there's really good kind of theoretical evidence for this idea that, you know, when different organisations are all calling for different things, it fragments the message. So there's a lot of trust in the idea that if we can, you know, show consensus, because really that's the most powerful tool we have. You know, we're not rich organizations. We don't have big PR budgets and big lobbying budgets, so our most powerful tool in the toolbox is to say, well, look, we all agree. You know, the doctors agree, the dentists agree, the cancer charities, the heart charities, we all think this is the right thing to do. That instills confidence, and all the organizations have seen the impact of that consensus in tobacco and in things like the sugar tax as well. So they're committed to the idea of working in partnership. You know, where there's a tension is that we all know that there are multiple causes of obesity, and therefore there need to be multiple approaches. But when it comes to policy progress, you need to kind of double down on, you know, two or three at a time. You can't go to the government and say, we want these 20 things, because that's just not realistic.
Yeah, or they, the benefit that they take from that is, oh, it's a cloud of ideas. We can get lost in all of these.
We'll just do these two. And,
Now, the problem I have with all of these issues really is that quantifiable nutritional benefit analysis is extraordinarily complex and very difficult to see some positive outcomes. Do you have some specific aims? Have you put a line in the sand and say, we want to achieve a specific thing? Or at least, is there a target that you want the British population to achieve?
Yeah, so I mean, the government has an existing target, which is to halve childhood obesity prevalence by 2030, which we think is doable. On the basis of what they're doing, I think we can get some of the way there, but there needs to be more in the next 7 or 8 years to reach that target by 2030. When it comes to adults, we did talk a lot about, you know, do we want a target? I mean, but the government has set lots and lots of targets. You know, in the last, I think the first target was set, I think it was 30 years ago, and it was to reduce, it was to halve adult obesity by then, or to take it back to the previous year's level, which I think would take it back down to about 7%. I mean, can you imagine how pleased we'd be if adult obesity...
I'd be very chuffed if we could get anything near that.
Yeah, or even what it was at the time, which I think was 12%. So you know, we've had targets. And also, we have no power to enforce a target. You know, we can say to the government, this should be your target. But actually, we kind of thought, well, we could argue for ages about what the target should be. But what's more important is actually doing something to get somewhere, you know, rather than obsessing over, you know, what the target is. Because what we've seen in the past, government set targets, then they don't do anything with them. It's the doing that's more important than the target itself.
So you must have a very good understanding of what's been done in the past. So tell me this, what works and what doesn't work when it comes to public nutritional campaigns?
So it's a really difficult question, isn't it? Because I said before, no country in the world has achieved a reduction in obesity at a population level. So we don't have an example that we can point to where we can say, right, this country did it and this is how they did it. This is the evidence for how you reduce obesity. You know, it doesn't exist. And because of the complexity of obesity and the kind of the multifactorial nature, one policy will not achieve, you know, a shift in obesity. And that's been a hostage to fortune in the past. You know, we see it with things like, you know, critics of the soft drinks industry levy will say, well, it was designed to address childhood obesity. Childhood obesity hasn't reduced, you know, so it's the unsuccessful policy. You know, well, of course it is, because, you know, while, you know, we've removed sugar from soft drinks, which is brilliant, and I think we will start to see some really tangible benefits in dental health in the next couple of years, you know, that alone is not going to result in a population shift in obesity.
And also the concept of possibly it is less bad than it could have been, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and that's really hard to measure, isn't it? You can't, you know, especially when you've got things like, you know, the last couple of years, that we don't yet know what the impact of that is on, you know, on population weight as well, but we think it's probably not going to have helped.
Yeah. I'm just going to drop in here to mention a couple of other recent additions on this topic. There's one with Dr. Jennifer Dixon and Anna Taylor of the Food Foundation on whether the government's food strategy is working, and one on the psychology behind why we make bad food choices in the first place. They're both up on the website and you can find them at foodmatterslive.com. Now, back to Caroline. Now, we've tried some of these things before, hasn't really worked. Often fruit and veg are just, I mean, they are they're the cheapest thing in the supermarket. Fresh fruit and veg, as long as they're available to people, are very cheap. People still choose the unhealthy options, partly because they're time poor, they don't necessarily have the skills to cook, they don't have the inclination, they want to eat things they know they like, and it's very difficult to tell people not to eat the things they like. How do you cut through that and make a difference? And if you, are there any practical examples that you're working on that should help to do this?
But you know, the key point here is agency. Fruit and veg may be available to most of us, not all of us, but it's about having to make that choice, you know, to choose fruit and vegetables. And that can be a hard choice to make because you may not have the resources around you to be able to do something with the fruit and veg that you're buying. You know, you just mentioned a couple of things. You might not have, you know, might not have a fridge, might not have, you know, kitchen equipment or time. Your children, you know, might not like it, and you might be on a limited income, so it's safer to choose something that you know they're going to eat. You're not going to waste money that way. But also, we've all been exposed to this years and years of worth of marketing that tells us that, you know, we deserve the unhealthy option. If we're too tired to cook, then, you know, order a delivery, or if we're, you know, if we're had a hard day, you know, have a biscuit, have a break, you know, treat yourself. And that's a really hard thing to overcome because marketing is so powerful.
And well-funded.
Yeah, and it creates these kind of brand associations and it normalizes that sort of food choice. So saying to people, you've got to overcome all of that and make a good choice, you know, it's almost impossible. You know, it's hard for me, and I kind of live and breathe this stuff every day. But you know, I'm still very susceptible to these types of messages.
So, would 50 million from the government put into advertising fresh fruit and veg by people who are clever, the people that started off advertising the fizzy drinks and the sweets, and the burgers and the delivery services? Do you think that would have an impact?
Probably not, no, because you know there's decades. We've all been exposed to decades of this. You know, You've got to undo all those kind of, you know, primal associations in our brains that you know it would have to overcome. That I think it would work. No.
Okay, so I'm interested in you mentioned at the start of our conversation a shift in perceptions about obesity that's required. Now, the central premise of Turning the Tide, I believe, is that we need to reframe obesity as a collective problem than an individual one. This is a big difference in what has been thought before. You know, I think that certainly, you know, a lot of newspapers do a lot of fat shaming. You know, this person is not good or has no control because they are overweight. Will it really help people to lose weight to shift this idea from it being my fault? Because there's a lot of sort of blaming. There's a lot of fault analysis going on. How do you think that ought to change?
Yeah, well, I think it's really clear. I mean, there's really good evidence that shows that weight stigma leads to kind of maladaptive, counterproductive behaviours. You know, it can lead to people eating more. It can lead to them, you know, stop seeking medical help. It is bad for us, but it's also everywhere. So if fat shaming was so effective, you know, you'd think it would be working by now because it is everywhere. So it clearly isn't working. And I think, you know, particularly for a lot of people, you know, who may have been in the obese category, you know, for a number of years, you know, we know that it's very hard for them to lose weight through, you know, willpower alone. It's just not going to happen because of the way the body holds onto and stores weight. So they you know, they need proper medical kind help and intervention. It, you know, really isn't their fault.
Do you think the diet industry has a lot to answer for? The stream of messages that comes out saying you could be a better person if only.
Oh, it's hard, isn't it? There's a lot of I see quite a lot at the moment on kind of social media about kind of the diet industry and kind of the role it plays. I mean, there is good evidence for some elements of that industry. I think it's definitely an argument for better regulation about what it can promise. You know, like the food industry, it's not a big homogenous group that I think we can say it's all bad.
So there's an interesting paradox here. Now, you mentioned the smoking concept, where you know there has been a quantifiable reduction, but I would say that a large part of the smoking concept is the stigma around it, that the sort of anti-smoking, it's an anti-social concept, and that the negativity is part of the campaigns that have managed to halve the smoking rates. Now, That's a sort of negative view of something that you do. Now, isn't that if you take that away from the obesity concept, does that cause problems, do you think?
No, I don't think so. And I would kind of disagree as well that the stigma for smoking has caused that. I think, you know, certainly those of us working in the health community wouldn't want to stigmatise smokers in any way. You know, people who smoke don't want to smoke. For the most part, you know, they hate it, but they're addicted. They're often targeted from a very early age through marketing. You know, it's not that dissimilar to you know, how the obesogenic environment affects us. And it's been effective policy. It's been reducing availability. It's been, you know, taxes, yeah. Marketing restrictions that have led to those reductions in smoking, and support, the availability of compassionate, evidence-based support to help people stop smoking.
Yeah. So what would you like to see over the next 10 years with the nation's obesity levels, and what really needs to happen to get there? What are there low-hanging fruit? Are there simple things that we can do and then move on to the trickier concepts? How do you see it unfolding?
First of all, what we need is a kind of a sustained commitment. So where we struggled over the last few years is that obesity policy is heavily politicised. And so with each change in government, we're kind of almost starting from scratch. It takes a while for them to, you know, to get going and to start to understand the evidence and take an evidence-based approach, which focuses, you know, on environment rather than education and awareness campaigns, which we know, you know, for most people, that's their default. You know, well, let's just run a few awareness campaigns and let's teach cooking in schools. That tends to be where everyone kind of lands at first. And you have to kind of move them towards, well, we tried that and it hasn't worked. This is what the evidence says. So if we could keep that commitment, so we're not kind of constantly kind of going up and down and starting from scratch with new policies, that would be really, really good. At the moment, the government has accepted that we live in a world that makes it very, very hard for people to maintain and reach a healthy weight. So just keeping that kind of focus would be really helpful. And then taking this kind of incremental approach where we introduce a raft of policies, like hopefully next year we'll have our 9 p.m. watershed, we'll have restrictions on promotions, we evaluate, we understand where the gaps are, where's marketing going, now it's not on TV, it's not online, let's fill those gaps with further policy. We also need new policies, so the National Food Strategy, which came out a couple of months ago, included a really totemic policy to really go upstream. And tax manufacturers on the basis of sugar and salt that they're purchasing for use in their products. Definitely need to do something in that sphere. It's top of the tree stuff. You know, we're going right to where the root of the problem is, and you know, trying to change food, you know, at its source.
I'm interested in your own personal view of this. Is there one area that you have a raging frustration about this? Are there simple things that you just think, why can't we just simply do this bit of it? And I know that this is a complex area and there are lots of aspects to it, but mm-hmm. but what do you kind of, what burns inside you that says, come on, just do this thing at least?
What's the hill I will die on?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what it is? It's something really small, and it's cake sales at school. And it's because my journey in this job in particular has been very much framed around kind of the ages of my children. So when I started this job, my children were kind of preschoolers. And, you know, the thing that made me rage was cartoon characters on products. You know, yeah. Going to the supermarket, the Pesta Power, they wanted the yogurt with the Peppa Pig on, or, you know, they wanted, yeah. If there was Minions or something, then, you know, that was it. That was what they wanted. As they got older and they started staying up later and watching more primetime TV, it was the advertising, the 9 p.m. watershed, and that's been a big focus. And that's something I'm personally, you know, really proud that you know, we'll hopefully see next year. Because, it, you know, I just saw how pervasive it was. You know, everything they wanted to watch was just stuffed full with you know, pizza and burger adverts. As my oldest has just turned 12 and he's walking to and from school on his own now, and its availability now that's really starting to come to the fore. This idea that, you know, he can go to the shops after school, you know, with his friends, and they're all buying sweets, and, you know, they all, that's, you know, what they want to do. And there's a sense that, you know, parents control what their children eat. But once they're walking to and from school, then you've got no control of that.
Welcome to the rest of your life.
Yeah, but the constant has always been the cake sales at school.
There, it does. It has always felt quite tricky, hasn't it? You kind of think, yeah, cake sales, great. The kids love it, and it's really nice to make cake. Oh my God, we're giving them cake, and we're celebrating, and that's the party, and we're making this the positive thing. It you're absolutely right. It's really tricky
making money out of selling cake. I kind of think, you know, schools is an environment where it should be best practice. It should be, you know, held to account. We teach them about healthy food, yet we're sending a completely different message, you know, by what's in the playground.
and that's the party bit, you know, that's the big most exciting part of the day is the flipping sugar.
Yeah.
And it's a bit right. I mean, there were a whole group of parents at my kids' primary school who would meet their children, pick them up with a Kit Kat. It's like, no, because literally all of our kids were going, they get that, why can't we?
And I hear a lot of that. Everyone else.
Okay, so my final question really is to make this a little bit smaller scale. We've talked about the big picture. You've got a wealth of experience on tackling obesity, and you probably know all the right things to do for a healthy diet. Is there one thing you wish people knew if they're struggling with weight? And we're not talking about strategy here. We're talking about practical application of different things that you can do. Is there one particular secret that you to eating to avoid obesity that you would like to shout about?
Not necessarily in terms of, you know, eating, because it's such a, you know, so many different factors affect how we eat, why we eat. There's a lot of genetics, there's a lot of, you know, where you live and how you live that really come into play. So, you know, what works for me wouldn't work for other people. But I think when it comes to, you know, weight management, I'm not a healthcare professional here, but, you know, we spoke to a lot of people, you know, living with obesity as part of the strategy development process. And, you know, what really struck me was when they found a healthcare professional that you know, was kind to them and listened to them and said, we can help you, how much that helped them, and, you know, how that then went on to kind of influence their health more broadly, not just their weight, but their health as well, was really totemic. So I would say that, you know, healthcare professionals, you know, they want to help, and we've got lots of evidence-based treatment and support programs. So don't feel that it's something that people should have to kind of, you know, blame themselves, say, oh, I just need to go to the gym more, I just need to, you know, eat less. You know, go and get help, go and talk to a health professional, go and talk to a GP or a dietitian or someone, because I think that journey can be really successful, and it was life-changing for some of the people we spoke to.
Yeah. Well, Caroline, I still believe that you've got an enormous mountain to climb, but thank God you're trying to climb it. That's all I can say. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live, with me, Stephen Gates, and my guest today has been Caroline Cherney from the Obesity Alliance. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts. It's all about food, from how to innovate in the industry to how to get a career in food communication. Recent highlights include editions on intermittent fasting and food health claims. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatterslive.com. Thank you so much for listening.